Maccast, Sunday, December 4th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Maccast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Well, here we are. It is December. The holiday season is already upon us. It just seems like it came way too fast. I would think that this happens every year, and actually it does. It sort of sneaks up on you, but here we are. I hope it's going well for you so far. You know, something about these intros that I've always struggled with is it's the hardest part of the show for me, honestly. I don't really know how to start it. And I'm looking over the show notes here today, and I know one of the things that I had started to do, just because I was never really sure what to do at the top of the show, I don't like podcasts that do a lot of just random banter. So I try not to do that on this episode, or on this show, rather, excuse me. But what I started doing was sort of just running down the stories, and I'm looking over the notes, and as we have more stories and things like that, to me, sometimes that feels sort of tedious. So I guess what I'm getting to and what I want to ask you is, you know, what's your thought? Should we just jump right into everything? Do you want a little bit of upfront show banter? I know, and it seems like I should have asked this more than, you know, a long time ago, I guess a lot longer ago than I am now. But what do you think? You know, how should we start the show? I could go over all the things, and we're going to be talking about, and I'll just summarize a few. And I think maybe this is the better way to go, is I'll just talk about a few of the high points. We're going to talk about the whole iCloud calendar spam thing. We've got updates on the iPhone 8, of course, some more news and information about what's going on with the latest MacBook Pros, and Apple maybe using drones in maps and some car stuff. That, along with all of your feedback, we're going to follow up on touch disease a little bit, talk about Apple's org chart and how it may be holding back the Mac. I got some great feedback from a listener on that, and a couple more tips and tricks, and I've got some pretty cool thing of the moment for you this episode. So that's a short rundown without telling you everything, and I think maybe that's the better way to start the show. But let me know what you think, and we'll move on to this episode. So before we do that, of course, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. Actually, I'm very happy to have this sponsor back. It's Drobo. You know, we're getting near the end of the year now, and as Maccast listeners, you know that this is the time of the year when I will start talking to you about backing up and archiving your data and files for the end of the year. It's something I try and do every year around this time. And of course, you're going to need a place to store that stuff, and I think a perfect solution for that is a Drobo. I actually use a couple of Drobos at my house. I use Chronosync scripts. I've covered this on the show in the past to actually automatically archive my important documents and files to my Drobos throughout the year. So it gives me less work to have to do at the end of the year when I automate that stuff. But why use a Drobo? Why would I recommend that? For me, it's the simplicity. It's the expandability and the security, you know, the security knowing that my files are going to be safe. So simplicity, it's super easy to set up. Basically, you plug it in, you add in the hard drives, you run the setup software, and you start archiving your stuff. You start using it. It's really that simple, really kind of plug and play. And I love that about it. Plus, you have just one device, so not a lot of clutter. You've got one device, one cable if you're hooking up directly, or if you're using a network attached one, it's off in another room and it's plugged into Ethernet. Really that simple. And then it's expandable. So you can start off with just a couple drives and it'll work fine. When you start to run out of room, you just add another drive. Or if you want to upgrade and add more storage, you can replace a drive with a larger one in one of the bays. It's really that simple. And you get lights and notifications to let you know when you need more storage. And then on the security side, Drobo uses a technology they call Beyond RAID. And that pretty much just means that it's going to take care of all of that protection stuff for you. Your files are protected against a single or even multiple hard drive failure. And all you do to set it up is plug in the drives. It will take care of the rest, and it even protects your data if there's a sudden power outage. So it will, they have a little calculator. You can figure out how much storage you're going to get versus, you know, some of the overhead has to get taken for the data redundancy, but it manages all that for you, and they have a great range of products to meet everyone's needs. The Drobo product family offers devices with 5, 8, even 12 hard drive bays, so you can get as much or as little as you need dependent upon what your needs are, and you can choose from both direct connected or network attached solutions. And guess what? No dongles here, because they have models with USB 3, USB-C, Thunderbolt 1, Thunderbolt 2, or you can connect over a network using gigabit Ethernet. So they have all of the connectors. Just pick the right Drobo for your need, and away you go. And best of all, MacCast listeners, right now, Drobo is giving you their best deal of the year. You can save 20% or more off your purchase of a Drobo 5N, a network-attached system, or the Drobo 5D or 5DT, which is the Thunderbolt and USB model, or any of the 8 or 12 bay unit network systems. That's a savings between $100 to $800 based on the model that you choose. So to take advantage of this incredible deal and to purchase your Drobo now, visit drobostore.com and then be sure to enter the code MC20. That's MC20 at checkout to get your discount. And a big thank you to Drobo for their support of the MacCast. Well, happy holidays, as I said at the top of the show. And for that, this year, apparently we're all getting some spam, some really annoying spam. You likely woke up on Black Friday, if you were like me and like many other of the MacCast listeners out there, to find a calendar invite on your calendar for a great deal on Ray-Bans. What more could you want, right? Or some other offer, maybe, that you didn't ask for. Yes, there is a whole separate special level of hell for spammers. That's something I totally believe. These guys are the scum of the earth. I hate this stuff. And I can't believe we're having to deal with this. But what's happening, in case you were wondering, is they're taking advantage of an iCloud feature that detects and recognizes events coming into your email and then will automatically create calendar events for you. It's something that I love. It's actually a feature I love. It's very convenient, and it makes it very easy for me to keep track of my schedule. But right now, what spammers have discovered is that they can just randomly generate, well, they're randomly generating and targeting iCloud accounts, basically, because they realize this feature exists. So if you have an iCloud account, you probably got hit by this, or a .me or a .mac, whatever, you get the idea. If you've had an email with Apple for any length of time, you probably got one of these. And they're just randomly going through every iteration, every variation of the email, and sending these things out. And that's how they ended up on your calendar. Now, the trouble is that if you simply decline the calendar event, which is what you'd want to do, it sends a notification back to the spammer. And guess what? Now they've verified that randomly generated email is valid, and that's probably just going to invite more spam into your inbox and also probably into your calendar. So a lot of people emailed me this week to say, what is going on here and what can I do about it? Well, what you can do, there's actually two things right now that you can do. If you want to stop the stuff completely from showing up in your calendar, you go into iCloud.com. So visit the iCloud website, sign in, go to the calendar, and then click the little gear icon and choose preferences. And then in the preferences pane on iCloud.com, you're going to click advanced. And under there, there's an invitations section. And you'll see a receive event invitation as, and there's two options there. One is email, and the other is the default in-app notifications. So just switch that over to email to email any of the invitations, and now the invites are going to stay in your inbox and email, and you can simply delete them from there if they're spam ones. They're not going to automatically wind up on your calendar. Of course, the big disadvantage here is that legitimate invites that you might want on your calendar are also going to have to come into email, and you're going to have to click them in email to add them to your calendar. So it adds this extra step, and I kind of don't like that. Now, if you already have spam in your calendar and you haven't already done the decline thing and you want to delete them without notifying the spammers, there's something you could do there as well. In the calendar app, add a new iCloud calendar. It's very important that it is an iCloud calendar, not a local one. When I did this, I just called the iCloud calendar something like spam. It doesn't really matter what you name it, because it's only going to be here temporarily. Once you have that set up, you move the spam invites to that calendar and then select that iCloud calendar and delete it. And once you delete it, you'll get a dialog that pops up and it will ask you if you want to delete and notify or if you'd like to delete and do not notify. And unfortunately, delete and notify is the default. So don't hit enter. Make sure you go over and click delete and do not notify that button. And that will safely remove the spam from your calendar without notifying those nasty, nasty spammers, die, spammer, die, without notifying them that they got a valid email. Now, long term, this isn't really ideal, right? Fortunately, Apple is aware of the problem, and they actually made a statement to Rene Ritchie over at iMore, and he passed it along to the community. So thanks, Rene. Basically, they said, we are sorry that some of our users are receiving spam calendar invitations. We are actively working to address this issue by identifying and blocking suspicious senders and spam in the invites being sent. That's great. I'm glad Apple's taking that step. But really, I think they need to do a little bit more. And I'm hoping that they do. I think that they will. I think we'll see some changes in OS X and into the calendar application, both on the Mac and iOS, to kind of address this. One immediate thing I think a lot of us are calling for is for them to add an option that when I decline a calendar invite, that I have the option to not notify the sender that I was declining it. It seems a little counterintuitive, but I think there are some situations, even without the spam thing, where you might want to decline a calendar invite and not necessarily notify the sender. I think this is actually a feature I've been told in Outlook or Exchange if you're on the Microsoft platform. But I would also love to see Apple change that setting, that iCloud setting that you could go in and change so that you can allow the in-app notifications, but from a sort of whitelist, a filtered list. And I think the logical list would be people that are already in my contacts. So if I have that person in my contacts that's sent me that email, that invite, go ahead and let them automatically add their event to my calendar. But if they're not in my contacts, just simply send those ones to email so that I can kind of cruise through them and decide, oh yeah, that is something that I want, or know that that is spam. I think that would be a very simple solution. Hopefully someone at Apple is listening to this, or they probably have already thought about it. You know, they're pretty smart over there. And those are the kinds of changes I'm hoping are going to happen. But I know a lot of you this week emailed me to say you were getting these calendar spams and you really didn't know where they were coming from or what to do. So hopefully that sheds some light on the whole issue and gives you a way to manage that. We got more evidence this week of a bigger 10.5-inch or larger iPad coming. This time it is Digitimes that is echoing some of the earlier reports that I think we've talked about on past episodes. They say that Apple is going to update the entire iPad line and that it will probably happen sometime in the first quarter. They gave a big range from January to March, but typically around the March, April, May timeframe is where Apple does those updates. They are saying that there will be a new size iPad, a 10.5-inch iPad Pro model that would come along with an updated 9.7-inch iPad mini, a 9.7-inch iPad Air, and an updated 12.9-inch iPad Pro. The Pro models are expected to feature a new Apple A10X processor. We don't have a lot of other details other than the new 10.5-inch model would actually be almost bezel-less to kind of fit the same form factor as the current 9.7. So we get a larger screen, but not necessarily a larger device. Now, some of the reports I have read are saying it would be just slightly larger. Other ones are saying it would maintain exactly the same form factor. And as a matter of fact, Macatakara thinks that the new 10-inch iPad will actually be a massive 10.9 inches and will feature what they're calling a micro bezel, giving the large screen the same footprint as the current 9.7-inch model, which would be, I think, pretty cool. And one of the reasons being given for Apple wanting to increase the screen size is apparently education market likes the slightly larger 10-inch plus screen size, and they don't necessarily want to go all the way up to the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, nor can their budgets necessarily afford it. So that sort of makes sense. Another cool thing about the new redesigned iPads is that supposedly the top bezel is going to still house the FaceTime camera and mics. It'll be, you know, smaller, but the home button will be completely removed. And this is something we've heard rumored for the next generation iPhone, but this is the first time we're really hearing about it on the iPad. No home button, the Touch ID sensor all integrated into the glass, and the side bezels would be significantly reduced. And that's how they're going to get that larger screen in that same size form factor. Now, one other interesting thing about this report is they're saying Apple may actually increase the thickness of the iPads just slightly to about 7.5 millimeters, which would be the same thickness as the iPad Air. And considering that over the past couple generations, thinness seems to be the target Apple's been shooting for, this is probably good news. It maybe means a little bit more battery in there, maybe some increased battery life. We'll have to wait and see. But we should see some new iPads sometime in the first quarter of next year. What's happening with those next generation iPhones? Well, there's a interesting report coming out this past week that Apple's actually exploring as many as 10 or more different designs for the 10th anniversary edition of the iPhone. The one common rumor we keep hearing is that Apple will finally move the display to an OLED display in 2017, at least for one or more of the models. There's a few models being rumored as, you know, that Apple may release. To that end, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Apple has asked their suppliers, their display suppliers, to actually increase their output of organic light-emitting displays. There's a lot of pressure. A lot of people are wondering how Apple is going to get the quantity and volume of OLED displays that they need, especially if they don't want to rely heavily on Samsung, which a lot of the reports are saying they don't. They'd like to use other suppliers, but really Samsung sort of has the market cornered on OLED production at this point. A lot of people are playing catch-up. I think LG Displays is trying to build some new plants and things like that, and we've talked about that on prior episodes. If Apple can't get enough of those OLED displays for their new model, a couple things could happen. Some, like I said, are saying that Apple may only include an OLED display in their very highest end iPhone 8 Plus model, the large size model. Others are saying that Apple may give up on OLED altogether and just stick with IPS panels across the board so that they can have a consistent technology, something that they've typically liked to do. They kind of like to have all the models have the same display technology because they can control things a little bit better. This time around, it's seeming like the first option is where they may land. It's believed, as I said, that they're going to have three updated models. This new high-end flagship model would have the OLED screen. It would be sized, the screen size would be between 5.1 and 5.2 inches. I think we talked about this on the last episode of the MacCast, but the actual device would be a massive 5.8 inch device, and it would have this wraparound display. The one thing about this rumor that rings in my mind is, does it sound like some sort of mashup between the Galaxy Note and the Galaxy Edge to you? That's what it sounds like to me, and that feels like Apple's kind of moving into this following role when it comes to its phone designs rather than being the leader, which is a little bit, I was going to say frustrating to me, but a little bit concerning, I guess, that, you know, Apple's moving to this place. But if that's what the market wants, then it kind of makes sense. And as you'll hear a little bit later, it's looking like there's some excitement generating around this next generation model, which could ultimately help out Apple. The other two models are believed to be a redesign of the current iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus. So a 4.7 inch size and a 5.5 inch size. So a little bit of a rev of the design, but not as much as this flagship high-end one. So we may be moving from two different phone choices to three. And I'm not so sure how I feel about that, especially considering that the top of the line one with all of the latest and greatest features in the OLED display is going to be the massive 5.8. And you know how I feel about those large size gigantophones. So for the flagship model, Apple has also reportedly asked suppliers to give them a better resolution display than is currently available on the market. And that is supposedly so that they can better compete against Samsung and some of the other premium phones that are out there right now. Apple also will reportedly bring wireless charging to all of the models. So that kind of brings into question, are we still going to have a Lightning connector? Is there a reason for that to exist? I think there is, so that we can do actually fast syncing of data through a cable rather than having to rely on wireless. But knowing Apple and their design choices, I wouldn't put it past them. And I'm sure one of those 10 prototypes is one that has no sort of ports on it whatsoever. So that could take the whole, hey, it doesn't have a 3.5 millimeter jack, to a whole new level in 2017. We'll have to wait till rumors get a little bit stronger before we start freaking out about that one, but I'm sure it's going to come up on future episodes. As far as the design goes, they are expected for all of these models to have this all-glass design, so they're going to be getting rid of the metal back, going with glass on front and back, and there's supposedly going to be this thin aluminum frame to add rigidity, and then so all the components can be attached to it, but will be mostly glass designed. The design will also supposedly put the FaceTime camera beneath the screen, and just like we talked about on the rumored next generation iPad, integrate the Touch ID sensor and home button into the display, so that will give it this seamless edge-to-edge display design. It really sounds like it's going to be a beautiful device, and Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that this 2017 iPhone could see record demand. He's reporting that Apple is ramping up production to have between 120 million to 150 million units ready for the second half of 2017, and he believes consumers are going to respond really well to the new design changes and the new features like the OLED display and the wireless charging, and that we could see iPhone sales growth again, which would be really great to see. I hope it happens. I think also some of the upgrade cycles are sort of lining up for that to happen. And consumers really seem to like a brand new design, something that doesn't look like the current thing that they already have. And they're maybe more apt to upgrade should that happen. So it's looking to be a pretty banner year for the iPhone in 2017. When iFixit did their teardown of the new Touch Bar MacBook Pro, they noted a extra connector that wasn't attached to anything. So they were hoping to go in there and find that, just like the 13-inch function row model, that it would have a removable SSD. It turned out the SSD storage was soldered on the motherboard, but they found this little extra port. And it turns out this little extra port is actually a service port for Apple to be able to use to recover data from the SSD storage on a failed machine. And when you think about this, this makes sense. Actually, I had an email from a listener who was like, hey, since the SSD is soldered on the motherboard, you know, what happens if I have a machine that can't boot and it needs to get swapped out? You know, how do I get my data from one machine to the other? Now, you know, my answer hopefully would be that you have a backup of that data and you couldn't recover from your backup. But assuming that you don't, assuming Apple's going to swap your machine in the store, what can they do? Well, it turns out Apple stores will have a special piece of equipment that they can use to attach to this little connector to attempt to migrate your data from your old machine to a new one, if should they need to replace it. Because, you know, and so the way this machine works is it's a device that has an actual logic board holder. 9to5Mac actually had a picture of it. So they can take the logic board out of the old machine. They put it in this little device. It has a power adapter, and it can be connected to another MacBook to actually try and migrate the data. So they insert your logic board, connect it via USB-C to another MacBook Pro, and can try and recover the data. And like I said, it's needed because you can't remove the SSD drive and just install it in another one or move it to an external case like we used to do back in the day, right? That's kind of how we did the emergency recover repair if our machine died and we couldn't get the data off of the hard drive, you know, if it wouldn't boot up. So, and, you know, almost any repair now for the new MacBook Pros, because everything's soldered together, is going to require swapping the logic board. So that includes doing things like Touch ID repairs or wireless card failures, all of that new logic board. So you're going to want to be able to pull the data off that. And the service will be provided and covered for anyone who is under AppleCare. If you're outside of AppleCare, I'm assuming there's going to be some sort of charge for that. So again, I would still rely on having my own backups to recover my own data, and then you really wouldn't have to worry about it. But it's kind of cool that this little machine exists and that Apple actually thought this through about, you know, how do we manage this with the memory actually being soldered, or the storage actually being soldered on the motherboard. And one other little MacBook Pro thing. DigiTimes believes that Intel will announce the what I'm going to call should have been in the new MacBook Pro H series Kaby Lake processors at CES in January. So Apple had to go, as you know, with the last year processor technology in their updated MacBook Pro because Intel didn't have the new series processors ready. Well, now we're hearing that the H series, all these new quad-core processors in Kaby Lake, designed for high-end gaming laptops and ultrabook class machines like the new MacBook Pros, those are going to be announced at CES in January. And I guess pouring a little more salt on the wound, NVIDIA is also expected to have their next generation 1050 graphics processors announced at CES right alongside those new Kaby Lake processors. So all of the good new power goodness that you would want in the MacBook Pro may be available in the first quarter of 2017. And I've said this on a couple other podcasts. I'm not sure that I've said this here. It seems to me like Apple maybe should have just waited an extra month or two to bring out the new MacBook Pro. I think a lot of people would have been irritated and angry and frustrated, and they would have taken a lot of heat for not getting any new Mac machines out in 2016. But I'm kind of feeling like the heat would have been worth it. So some people, myself included, now are hoping that maybe Apple will do a summer refresh of the MacBook Pro line so that they can add in the new technology. And I think that's likely to happen. I mean, it's not unprecedented for Apple to do a processor GPU rev of a machine sort of mid-year. So I think we could have a mid-2017 update of the new MacBook Pros. I'm not sure how that's going to make all of you who just bought a new 2016 MacBook Pro feel, but I think it would go a long way to making the community in general feel a lot better about what Apple's been up to, especially on the Mac side of things. And we're going to talk about some of that a little bit later in the show. A subject came up that I thought was very interesting, an article, and I want to comment on some of that. Those new MacBook Pros, unfortunately, some owners of them are maybe needing to take advantage of Apple's new data migration service sooner than expected. There are reports that some of the new machines are having display and GPU glitch issues. Some users are seeing tearing and graphic artifacts, random black and blue or black and red bars, freezing, kernel panics, crashes. And there doesn't seem to be any real indication of what the problem is. If it's hardware or software, it's a little bit confusing. Many of the early reports are noticing that the issues are happening when the GPUs are under intensive operations, like running media encoding, and especially when running Adobe applications for some reason. And some have some people have even reported seeing the issues in Apple's own Photos application. So that seems to indicate that maybe it's a hardware issue or maybe it's something related to OS X itself. It's not 100% clear at the moment. It's also not 100% clear at how widespread this issue is, but it's widespread enough that blogs are noticing it, and there's a pretty growing discussion forum thread on Apple's support website. So some believe it may be a third-party software issue, specifically with Adobe applications. Others think that the problem could lie in the new AMD Radeon Pro 460 graphics chip on some units. But still, there have been other reports that I read that claim people are having similar issues with the AMD Radeon Pro 450 and the AMD Radeon Pro 455. So again, it's really kind of ambiguous or unclear. And I've talked to a couple new MacBook Pro owners, and they haven't noticed any issues with their models. So I'm tending to think that this may be something related to software and specific applications that really push the GPU in intensive applications. And I'm really hoping that there is a software fix versus this being some sort of hardware issue. But if you are having problems, you probably want to report it to Apple, either call Apple Care or make a Genius Bar appointment, get it documented so that once they figure everything out, you can make sure that you're covered and that you get it resolved as quickly and easily as possible. But yeah, little GPU issue. And this kind of happens anytime there's some major architecture changes in Mac products. You tend to have these little glitches and issues that pop up once, you know, units start shipping in volume. So it's not really unusual, but it certainly is frustrating for those users who are impacted by this. One other issue that was noticed by Mac Rumors with the new MacBook Pro is some owners are claiming that they're not getting the battery life that Apple had advertised. As a matter of fact, they say that they're getting 30 to 60% of the 10-hour battery life that is supposed to be on their units, which means that some people's machines are dying after just 3 to 5 hours of use. Not necessarily good. Again, it's hard to say at this point what the issue exactly is and how widespread it is. My guess is that it's not that widespread, and these may just be weird edge cases where people are doing certain things or have certain kinds of software running that are maybe in the background running down the battery, and there's some sort of cause for that. This always happens again when new machines start hitting the wild, and like I said, battery use cases can vary widely. Most early reviews, and this is one of the reasons I'm kind of a little leery about this story, is a lot of the early reviews that did battery tests that I saw reported that they were getting good or even better than advertised battery life. So they were getting either the 10 hours or in some cases 11, 12 hours, depending upon the test. So we're going to have to kind of keep an eye on this one. If you have a new MacBook Pro and you've experienced battery issues, let us know about it. I'd love to try and find out how widespread this is just inside the MacCast community. So shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. I'm hoping I don't get any emails because that means everybody's batteries are good. And then the last thing on the MacBook Pros for this episode, Apple did issue a patch for the Bootcamp audio driver issue in Windows that I think I mentioned on the last episode of the MacCast. There were reports of people who are running the new machines in Bootcamp and Windows, and they were getting loud pops that were potentially damaging the speakers in the new MacBook Pros. And as a matter of fact, Apple had come out publicly and said, stop using Bootcamp Windows with audio applications until we can get this resolved. It looks like they have a patch out now, so you're going to want to make sure you hit Apple's support website and grab that if you're running Bootcamp on your new 2016 MacBook Pro. Over the past week or so, we've also been hearing of a couple different iPhone issues that I wanted to get into. One we've already talked about a little bit, and that's the battery replacement program. Some iPhones will actually randomly shut off and not come back on. This is an issue affecting the iPhone 6S. Apple is replacing the batteries for what they are saying is a very small number of iPhone 6S devices that were manufactured between September in October of 2015. They say that the issue was actually caused by some batteries that were overexposed to controlled ambient air during the manufacturing process. And the problem can then cause the batteries to degrade faster than a normal battery. They have a checker, a battery checker or a serial number checker on their support website related to this issue. So if you bought an iPhone 6S early on, manufactured between September and October 2015, you probably want to head over there and check yours. If you do fall in the affected group, you can contact Apple for a battery replacement. And Apple says batteries will be covered for 3 years after the first retail sales date of your unit. So if you're not having the problem right now, you will continue to be covered under this program for a little bit. But I would say if you fall in the serial number range, you probably want to get in and have your unit looked at. I actually have an appointment for Monday because my iPhone 6S did fall in the serial number range. So I'll let you know, I'll report back how that goes, what Apple does. I have heard that some units, people are bringing them in, and if you haven't been experiencing the random shutdown issue, that Apple is not replacing the batteries at this time. Again, I'll let you know what I find out about that. If you've gone in for this issue, let us know your experience, too. Did Apple just swap your unit out, or did you kind of have trouble getting covered under this program? Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Also on the iPhone side of things, some users who upgraded to iOS 10.1.1 are reporting their units are having a similar sort of issue to the reported iPhone 6S issue, that they're seeing their battery drop significantly and even shut down before it's at 0% battery life. So some people are saying it'll get to 30% and just shut off. Some are saying, nope, my battery is just draining a lot more quickly. And many of the models that are in a discussion thread on this issue are not iPhone 6S models. I haven't personally had any issues with 10.1.1 on my iPhone 7. So, I don't know how widespread this is or what specific units are being impacted. It's just being reported by a number of users. And some are claiming that if you turn off the race to wake feature, it does help. I do know that Apple is through, I think, the fourth or fifth generation of the iOS 10.2 beta. So hopefully if this is a problem, there will be a fix for it when that update releases, which should be relatively soon. There's also one other program, repair program, not related to iPhones that I want to mention, and that is a repair program for the hinge on some 27-inch iMacs. Apparently, some 27-inch iMacs, the hinge will fail, causing you to not be able to hold the position of the display as you tilt it. If you do have that issue, there is a repair program for that. Apple will cover that and repair your 27-inch iMac for you. If you happen to have already gone in for a repair, you also might qualify for a reimbursement from Apple. So still contact them, even if you've already paid for that repair yourself. This next item isn't necessarily Apple's fault, but it is a epidemic that I think we need to be aware of and we need to talk about. An organization called Trading Standards commissioned a check of 400 Apple-branded chargers that they purchased from vendors in the United States, Australia, and China, various vendors in all of those locations, and they found that 99% of the devices that they tested, that they purchased and tested, were unsafe. They had the units tested by UL Labs, and they found that only 3 out of the 400 chargers that they collected, and again, remember, these are Apple-branded chargers that they got from various resellers, so claimed to be Apple OEMs, they had Apple logos on them, they had safety branding logos on them. Only 3 out of the 400 that they collected had enough insulation to protect against electric shocks. So if you got a great deal on an Apple-branded charger, you might want to be a little bit leery about the potential safety of that charger. It could be a knockoff one. I'm not saying it is, but it could be. And in this report, they mention a couple things to look for to kind of tell if maybe you have one of these counterfeit chargers. They say you can look at the plug-in pins and if they're not exactly the right size. So if you have a harder time plugging that into your socket, that may be a sign that there's a problem. They also mentioned that standards say you need to have at least 9.5 millimeters from the edge of the device or the unit to where the plug actually is, so you could maybe measure that. They also say check for those CE safety standard markings, although even in this report they note that those can be easily faked, so that's kind of a tough one. And they also mentioned that if you check the packaging that came with your charger, it should include a set of safety instructions in the package. It's required by law in many countries. So if that wasn't included in there, that could be a sign that maybe that charger is counterfeit. Apple definitely includes that in the packaging. So kind of think about with Apple-branded chargers, the little packet of information that you usually get and ignore. If you didn't get one of those, that could be a sign that you got a counterfeit one. But I still think the best bet, your best way to know is just common sense. You know, Apple sells their chargers for about $20 US. So if you're getting one for $5 or $3 and you're like, I'm getting a great deal on this, I think that's a clear sign that this is buyer beware. You're probably going to have to pay somewhere in the range of at least $15 US, maybe more, $20 for an actual Apple branded legitimate charger. And just be careful where you're buying from as well. You know, I think if you're buying from random seller on Amazon, that may be a problem. If you're buying directly from Apple or directly from a reputable Apple authorized reseller, you're probably going to be okay. And then one last thing related to general iOS security and issues that came up this week. Two researchers, one from India and another from Germany, both independently, or I think one discovered this flaw and then the second one sort of confirmed it independently, found a flaw in iOS that allowed them to bypass the activation lock on that device. So this is the security thing that's supposed to protect you. If you lose your device, someone can't go activate that device or access it. And what they discovered is a little exploit that allows them to take advantage of the fact that on a locked device, you can still connect to a Wi-Fi network. So if you aren't on one of your default networks, you can actually manually enter a Wi-Fi network. And this would be so that if you discovered your device, you can, of course, get back on a Wi-Fi network, say at a friend's house or some other location, and maybe reactivate your device. Well, that opened up a little hole where they discovered they could use a buffer overflow hack to actually crash the Wi-Fi service and gain access to the device. The way the attack is done is they enter very long strings of characters. In the example that I saw, they were putting in just a ton of emoji into the WPA2 enterprise username and password fields. And they would keep putting in characters until eventually the device would crash. And then once it crashed, they used the smart cover to put it to sleep and then wake it back up. And then as it woke back up, it should come back up to the Wi-Fi login thing, but it's frozen after about 20 or 30 seconds. It will actually crash that, and then the add to Wi-Fi connection screen actually crashes and dumps you right on to the home screen of the device, and then you are in there. Now, the German researcher, I think, had to do some rotating of the iPad before he could get it to crash to the home screen, but basically got exactly the same result. So the flaw was found and tested in iOS 10.1. It was reported to Apple back on November 4th, so they are aware of the issue. I would assume they're frantically working on a fix. The German researcher who verified the flaw also tested on a device, but his was running the latest 10.1.1. So we know it's in the very latest version of iOS. I'm not exactly sure how far back the flaw may go, but I would imagine it's been around there for a while. I actually had a couple listeners ask me at one point, hey, I lost my device and it was actually activated. I don't know how this happened. And I'm now wondering if maybe this was a flaw known in the sort of underground community and it's just coming to light now. Who really knows? But at least Apple is now aware of the issue, and hopefully they will find a fix and patch this fairly quickly. So we know Apple got out of the display business from the last event, where they're no longer making their loved and classic cinema display. Well, there was some other bad news over the past week or so. It's looking like Apple's getting out of the router business as well, the airport and time capsule business. This was reported by Bloomberg. They say that Apple's been slowly dissolving those teams, and they are moving on. They claim that Apple is doing this so they can sharpen the company's focus on consumer products that generate the bulk of their revenue. So Apple just probably not making a lot of money off airports and time capsules, even though people really love them. And again, this news comes as a shock to a lot of fans of the airport. And it was sort of made even worse by a little salt in the wound when Bloomberg reported that Apple's airport routers were ranked once again highest in customer satisfaction by J.D. Power. Apple actually scored a rating of 876 out of a 1,000-point scale, beating out the second-ranked router manufacturer Asus, who had a score of 860. And Apple was actually the only company whose router earned the J.D. Power 5 Power Circle rating. All of the others got four or lower. So, you know, Apple routers are great and people absolutely love them. It's sad to see Apple getting out of that part of the business, but I can kind of understand Apple's move in this arena. You know, they need to focus their products on their core technologies, and they really haven't updated those routers in a long time. I think I said this on the Mac show. It was either time for Apple to do a entire revamp of the AirPort and Time Capsule product line or get out, and I guess they just decided it's time to get out. It will certainly be missed, and I know a lot of you really love your AirPorts, but looks like Apple is out of that part of the business. Now we got to talk once again about the question of the year. When are we going to be able to buy those awesome new AirPods Apple showed us? Mac Rumors is reporting that a customer sent an email to Tim Cook asking, hey, when can we get a release date on these things? And supposedly Tim Cook's response was, quote, thanks for your note. Sorry for the delay. We are finalizing them and I anticipate we will begin to ship them over the next few weeks. Now, immediately after this hit the interwebs and the Twitters and all that fun stuff, many took it to mean that, hey, we're going to get AirPods before the end of the year. No doubt. They're shipping in December. Tim Cook said a few weeks or the next few weeks. Well, guess what? I'm not that optimistic. I'm really hoping I'm wrong, but we're talking about Apple speak here. We're not talking about the speak of mere mortals who would think a few weeks means maybe 3-4 weeks, something like that. In Apple speak, a few weeks, I think, could mean 3 weeks, it could mean 6 weeks, it could mean 8 weeks. It's a few. And he didn't say a couple. He specifically said a few. Again, I'm hoping I'm wrong, but the reality is I don't think at this point there's any reason for Apple to rush them out before the end of the year. I don't see any benefit. They've kind of already missed the holiday selling window. Unless they're going to start selling them, you know, Monday or something like that, they've kind of missed that opportunity. Some people have noted that maybe they'll put them on sale the week of Christmas and people could use their Christmas money to buy new AirPods, but I don't think that's necessary. I'd really like to see Apple build up some extra inventory because demand is going to be huge, and I'd hate to see another repeat of what we saw with the Apple Pencil. Now, some might argue, well, that's good for Apple sales because it shows that, you know, there's this high demand and more people are going to clamor to try and get their hands on that product. Yeah, that may be the case, but it'd also be nice to just have a nice Apple story to start 2017 that, hey, the AirPods came out and everybody who wants them can get them and Apple's selling them like gangbusters and everybody's happy and the world is wonderful. I know that's a lot to ask considering how things went in 2016, but a guy can hope, right? Anyway, that's the latest on the AirPods. How can Apple make maps better? Well, apparently they think one way is to use drones. Bloomberg is reporting that Apple is working on new improvements to Apple Maps, and that could possibly mean using drones for data collection. This comes about because Apple supposedly filed for an exemption from the Federal Aviation Administration on September 21st of 2015, saying that they would like to fly drones for commercial purposes. And supposedly on March 22nd, 2016, the FAA granted Apple's approval to, quote, operate an unmanned aircraft system to conduct data collection, photography, and videography. Now, the exception request mentioned that Apple planned to use drones from DJI and I think it's AIbotics for their data collection. I'm not familiar with AIbotics, but I think a lot of us are familiar with the DJI drones, which actually Apple sells in their Apple retail stores. Now, according to the report, the drone fleet would be used to examine street signs, track changes to roads, and monitor if areas are under construction. The one potential hang-up on this is that current FAA regulations here in the States do not allow commercial drone flights over people or buildings. So I'm not sure how Apple would handle that. My guess is that they plan to use the drones in maybe more rural areas and then also in other countries where maybe they're not going to face the same kind of current regulations that we have now here in the United States, at least when it comes to commercial drone flights. The other thing about commercial drone flights in the U.S. is you do have to have a certified pilot, and they are only allowed to fly line of sight. So that sort of limits maybe what Apple might be able to do. But still, it's an interesting thing. It'd be cool to kind of see some Apple drones flying around doing mapping stuff. And I'm all for anything that's going to make mapping better. Some other new features that are mentioned in the reports are that Apple is looking to provide indoor maps, including views of the insides of buildings. So that could be kind of cool if we can pull up on Apple Maps and see right inside different buildings and different areas. It's looking like they're going to start with things like airports and stadiums and malls and those sorts of things. And they're also mentioning that Apple's looking to do more improvements on in-car navigation. Just in general, I'd like to get your opinion on what you think about Apple Maps. Has it improved? Is it getting better? I think it's improved greatly, but I think they still kind of have a long way to go. I received reports over the past year or so of areas where, you know, things have been updated, freeways have been updated, construction projects have been finished, and Apple's still been very, very slow to update their data on Apple Maps, even though Google will be there and ready like day one. So I think Apple, you know, in general, I think they're doing a better job with Apple Maps. I think they just need to get more efficient and quicker about doing updates for kind of new things. And that does kind of sound like what they're trying to do with these drones is actually monitor sort of construction areas and zones and keep track of when road openings and things happen. So hopefully that means things are going to continue to get better. But, you know, what do you currently think of Apple Maps? Are you using it, or are you still, you know, using the Google stuff rather than defaulting back to Apple Maps? And then finally, we have news of a letter that Apple supposedly wrote to the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration here in the United States. And supposedly in the letter, Apple was asking that that organization treat new entrants into the auto industry with the same rights as established ones. Specifically, they say that established manufacturers do not have to pursue exemptions to the federal motor vehicle safety standards when attempting to test cars on public roads, but new entrants do. And so it's looking like Apple sort of confirming that they're working on a car. Well, maybe not so fast. In a statement to the Financial Times, Apple explained the letter, saying that they wanted to be sure that the NHTSA is defining the best practices for machine learning and autonomous systems. Further, they said that Apple is, quote, investing heavily in machine learning and autonomous systems, stating that these investments have, quote, many potential applications, including transportation, and that Apple wants to work with the NHTSA to help define best practices for the industry. So they seem to be wanting to spin this story to make it look like Apple's not necessarily working directly on a vehicle that they're going to be testing themselves on the roads, but more on machine learning and autonomous systems in general that might go into cars that might be tested on the roads. I know it's kind of a stretch, but that does seem to line up with the recent reports we've heard about Apple kind of restructuring its rumored, you know, Titan car project, that they've moved away from actually developing a car and they're more looking at artificial intelligence and autonomous car driving systems. And so to me, sort of what's in this letter and their public statement seems to kind of back that up. I think it shows that they are heavily invested in building an autonomous vehicle platform, and that they probably hope to partner with someone who could benefit if the NHTSA policies were more open to newcomers. I think it sort of points to the fact that maybe Apple's not going to pick to partner with a established auto manufacturer like Ford or something like that, that they may go with somebody more independent, a more up-and-coming company, and that, you know, if these policies were more open, they would benefit from that. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, again, it's the holiday times. Maybe you need some cash for some new gear, maybe for some gifts. A great way to get that is to sell some of your old devices, your old iPhone, your old Apple Watch. Gazelle makes doing that completely easy and pain-free. I think it's the easiest way to sell your device. And the way it works is you go to gazelle.com, you answer a few simple questions about the device you want to sell, the condition that it's in, and you instantly get a price quote. And you don't have to worry if the device is broken. Gazelle will accept those too. And you get that offer up front, so you have nothing to lose. Go to gazelle.com, plug it in. And once you accept that offer, Gazelle will honor it for 30 days. And shipping is completely free. And in a lot of cases, they will provide a box for you to send it in. So, like I said, easy and pain-free. Once they receive your device, they check it out. All the personal information is removed. And as long as it meets the specifications, the condition, and everything that you said, your payment is fast and quick. You can get a check in the mail. You can get an Amazon gift card right to your inbox and your email. Or you can even have direct deposit right into your PayPal account. And Gazelle has helped over 1 million customers sell their devices and paid out over $200 million to those customers. So get cash for your old iPhone, iPad, or Mac today. Go to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. So I want to play you this voicemail I received this week, and then I think I have a little bit of explaining to do.
Hey, Adam. My name is Jason Sherbel. Hey, I just wanted to provide a little information on this touch disease I just heard on the latest MacCast. It's kind of interesting that you bring this up because you were mentioning that everything was on a 6S Plus, and I suppose that's fine. My daughter had a 6 Plus, and she put it in her pocket a lot. She didn't drop it much, she claimed, but she put it in her pocket a lot, and I think we went through 4 replacements for this touch disease where the top of the screen starts to flicker and eventually just progressively gets worse to where you can't even do anything at all. The last replacement Apple did do outside of warranty with a little bit of gentle coercion or something on my part to get them to do it. They did finally replace it. I had to provide some videos and things of it happening and so on. But the point I wanted to make is your latest MacCast mentions that it's $150 to replace it, and Apple is blaming it on the user. We actually were about to walk out of an Apple store with a replacement for this issue, and before we even got to the door, we saw it starting to flicker. A brand new, I'm assuming refurbished or something, brand new iPhone 6 Plus started to show the issue before we even walked out the door. Unfortunately, the genius had needed us to prove it, and we couldn't prove it. You know, when we went back, you know, turned around, went back to the genius, because it wasn't happening enough. But within weeks, sure enough, we were back in the Apple store and getting yet another replacement. So anyway, I do believe it's something to do with the soldering and so on. This was on a 6 Plus, not the 6S Plus. So that's why the latest MacCast was confusing for me. But just wanted to share that little tidbit about it happening on a brand new replacement device within seconds of doing a restore on it. Have a good day. Thanks for all you do.
Hey, Jason, you're welcome. And that is crazy that it would happen that quickly and on a completely refurbished device. That's a little bit weird. But also, I think, directly points to the fact that that device isn't going to have user damage, right? It's coming right out of the box. And so when I was reporting the story, I think I was a little bit leery about that. The other thing that I need to apologize on, though, and explain is you're absolutely right. I was completely wrong with what I said on the last MacCast or that MacCast. The touch disease issue impacts the iPhone 6 Plus, not the 6S Plus, as I said. I somehow put 6S Plus into the show notes, which caused my error and likely confusion, not just for you, Jason, but for probably everybody listening to the episode. You probably all thought I was crazy. I'm surprised I didn't actually get more emails. I think the problem is that Apple's naming conventions, it's easy to slip up on that stuff. And I try not to make errors like that, but every once in a while, something like this slips through. So I'm glad you caught me on this. I'm glad we can make this correction now. But you're absolutely right. I think the bigger issue here that I'm having, and I'd love more reports like this, is I'm having a hard time believing with how widespread this issue is reported that it's user damage that's causing it. I think that's a bad form on Apple's part. And even if it was user damage that caused this, iPhones are going to get dropped, you know, and they should be able to be built to withstand that. I've seen Apple's sort of testing facilities and videos for products, and I can't imagine that they didn't test extensively for this and that it wouldn't have come out if that was specifically what the issue is. I really think this is related to the design of the product, it missing some of the sort of foundation behind that IC controller that it maybe should have, and I guess does have in later designs, according to the site that originally sort of reported this issue, the repair site. So, you know, Apple should stand up and make the correction on this. It was good to hear, at least for you, as annoying as it is that you've had that many replacements, that they've actually done the replacements for you without actually charging you. I now wonder that now that this program exists, if they will continue to do that. My guess is not, and you'll be asked to pay the $150. But, I mean, are they going to stand? Typically, when they do a repair like that, you only get an extra 90 days or so of warranty, I believe, on that repair. So are they going to stand behind that repair for longer than that? That's not really clear at this point either. And I just have a feeling they have another 2011 MacBook Pro on their hands where, you know, in that case, the graphics chip desoldered and they kept having issues. I was one of those victims of that and had, you know, 4 logic board replacements. So they would keep replacing them, but, you know, at some point you've got to just recognize it's a fatal flaw in the design of the system and do something more. But thanks for sharing your story, and certainly thanks for correcting me. Another question I had on the last episode of the Mac, I think it was the last episode of the MacCaster, it might have been a couple episodes ago, we were talking about the new Apple Melbourne store. And I was asking because there was some confusion. Reports were saying this was the first Apple store in Melbourne, Australia, but Apple actually has what looks like 5 stores, according to some reports, in that area. And I was confused about how that worked, not being from the region. And luckily, Joe lives there. He emailed me and he kind of sorted stuff out for us. So he explained that Apple currently does have 5 stores in the state of Victoria, which is where Melbourne is. But all of them are really located in the suburbs of Melbourne and what they call Greater Melbourne. And all of the stores are within about 40 kilometers, 25 miles for those of us here in the U.S. of downtown Melbourne. But there were actually no stores in the central business district, which I guess, according to Joe, is what they call that kind of downtown region. So the Apple Federation Square store, should it get built, would be Apple's first downtown Melbourne store. And as we talked about in that episode, there's some issues with that store going in because here's a big retailer in kind of this area, which Joe described as kind of having more boutique, kind of smaller stores and stuff like that. But he's all for Apple store going in. I think being an Apple fan and a listener to the MacCast, and I certainly would be for another Apple store anywhere in the world. I love Apple stores. So we've got a bunch here in the San Diego area. I'm lucky I have about 4 or 5 actually within probably that range, that 25, 30 mile range that I can visit. So hopefully you'll be getting another store down under. And thank you, Joe, for kind of clarifying things for those of us who don't live there. Now let's get to kind of one of the big topics I want to talk about in today's episode. Bill sent me a link to this great article over on Vox.com that talked about how Apple's organization chart, its organizational structure, may be the thing that is causing the slow updates to the Mac, the reason why Apple's not updating the Mac. And it's the idea that Apple organizes functionally versus by division. And I kind of thought I understood the difference, but I didn't really understand the difference. So I want to get into, you know, sort of the argument that this article was making. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to go read the whole thing. And I do recommend that you check it out if you're interested in this at all. But so what is the difference between a divisional structure and a functional structure of a company? And it was explained in the article that a divisional structure means that your management of the stuff that you make is focused on individual product lines. So you would have, if Apple was organized this way, and they're not, you would have a vice president of Macintosh and presumably a vice president of iPad and a vice president of services, a vice president of iPhone, and they would just oversee that one product line all the way through. Now, a functional organization is more based on the roles or functions regardless of the product line, which is why at Apple you see things like Johnny Ive being the chief design officer, but he's the chief design officer of all of the products, not just, say, iPhones or iPads, which you would have if you were more structurally or divisionally focused, rather. It's also why you have a VP of software or hardware technologies. So why is Apple functional? What's the benefit of that versus doing divisional? And the big benefit of a functional structure is that when you want your products to be integrated or to share technologies, it makes it easier. Functional structures allow for more collaboration across the different product lines and divisions and things like that. You're not sort of siloed. And so that's why, a great example of this is benefiting from chip technologies in iOS devices. It's why, you know, Apple Watch and, the Touch Bar share a provenance. They share a history in terms of the chips and the operating system that they're running on. You know, you don't have that just siloed to the iOS devices. You find it making its way into a Mac. And in a divisional structure, that kind of technology crossover wouldn't be impossible, but it's less likely to happen. So what's the problem with that? You know, how is that structure causing the Mac not to move forward, at least according to this piece? And I'm going to give you my opinions on this after I explain sort of the argument that the piece was making. And the piece was saying, you know, it's hard to run a large company under a functional structure. Because when things go wrong in, for example, a divisional structure, there's this kind of clear line of accountability. You know where the problem went or came from, and you can kind of hold people accountable. And in a functional structure, because you've got this sort of cross-pollination of stuff, it's a little bit more difficult to figure out where things maybe went wrong. I don't really understand exactly how that's a problem. I think Apple's the type of company where you don't want to just blame one person for some sort of problem. I guess maybe Scott Forstall would have an exception with that, but, you know, who knows? But the article went on to sort of make this argument that the Mac doesn't get the attention it needs anymore, should have anymore, doesn't get updated as frequently because it's really not any one person's job. And I guess this is where the accountability comes in. No one's really accountable necessarily for just the Macintosh. It's not one person's job to make sure that it's getting updated or things that are happening with it. With a functional structure, the more critical or what is seen as the more profitable products and what is seen as the more critical products get the attention over some of the other products. And if you look at Apple's sales and what is generating the most profits and the largest percentage by far, that is the iPhone. And the trouble for Apple is that to whatever degree, yes, all of their products are profitable, but percentage-wise, the iPhone vastly outranking the other ones sort of puts the focus there. And that's kind of the argument of the piece. And the piece does absolutely bring up what I consider to be some pretty good points. You know, the iPhone does require yearly updates to kind of maintain its position and relevance in the market. So it kind of demands that attention. And the iPad gets to kind of come along for the ride because it shares a lot of the parts and technology that are in the iPhone. So it's not that hard to go ahead and just update the iPad because you're kind of pulling some of the same core components and pieces and the processors all kind of work together in the operating system. And then services, you know, supports the iPhone. So of course it's going to get some pull up too from just the sheer fact that, hey, this is the iPhone. It's 66% of the revenue that's generated by the company. And then you have the poor Mac down there at the bottom of the totem pole. And, you know, within the Mac structure, the notebooks are arguably the most important part of the Mac piece. So the notebooks are going to get more attention, say, than the Mac Mini or the Mac Pro. And this is exactly what we're seeing. So this kind of argument being made by this this piece kind of makes sense. Now, I'm not sure I 100% agree with the conclusions that are made, but it does seem to map nicely to what Apple's been doing and what they've been up to. Things like dropping displays and routers and other supplemental products that could potentially take focus away from those more core things, the neglect of the desktop Mac, the slow rate of core technology updates to the Macintosh lines. All of these things sort of map. The one thing I noted is the piece does seem to ignore the divisional structures that exist, at least under those higher functional structures. So, you know, within individual teams, from what I've heard, say for iOS or tvOS or iPads or iPhones, they're largely operated independently with really not a lot of crossover or knowledge between the different subdivisions of what one or the other is really working on. So I'm not sure how that would play into this argument. So I'm a little confused because the piece kind of does ignore that. But, you know, in looking at it and stepping back from it and kind of taking out my own thoughts and opinions prior to reading this, I'm looking at this going, wow, this kind of makes sense. Now, they were arguing that Apple may be too big and that it needs to shift to a divisional structure so that, you know, products like the Mac can thrive and move forward. I don't know that if you look at Apple's corporate culture, that that could even work. You know, I think that would actually be a really bad idea. I think the whole company could probably implode if they tried to throw in a divisional structure at this point. It's just not the way Apple works. And I think a lot of the products would suffer because they would be missing this cross-pollination like we saw with, you know, the Touch Bar. And the Touch Bar, now that it's in people's hands, a lot of people are really loving it, and it's looking to be a sort of, you know, innovative, game-changing technology. So, you know, I don't think I would want Apple to change. And I don't necessarily think they should. But it does bring us back around to, well, what is it going to take for Macs to get a little more attention? Because sales continue to be okay. And at this point, it seems like, or it's starting to feel like, that if Apple continues to ignore the Macintosh and not bring regular periodic updates to the technology, they're going to continue to kind of alienate a pretty significant segment of their community. You know, right now, early signs are, at least in the pro and techie community, that we're reaching this tipping point. You know, we're starting to hear people say, well, you know, maybe it's time to go to Windows. Maybe it's time to get a PC. Maybe Apple's just not the computer for me anymore. And that may be the case. And Apple may be consciously trying to send that message out there and, you know, push those people aside. I want to hope and believe that that's not what they're doing. But I do think that if that's not the intention, they need to be a little bit more concerned than they seem to be about, you know, what many will agree is a small but very vocal part of the community, and they need to pay attention, more attention to the Mac. They might not want to admit it, and they might want to fool themselves and say they're not ignoring the Mac, but in many ways, they really are. And it's still a foundation, I think, that a lot of their business, including their iPhone and iPad business, is built on top of. It's also a part of their business that the influencers really feel are important. And the people that are telling their friends and non-technical people and family, and hey, you should get an iPad, or you should get a Mac, or you should get an iPhone. And I think that community, that core, is starting to show signs of cracking, and I think that's not very good. What should Apple do? I don't think they should change the org chart. I don't think they should change the divisional structure of the company, but I certainly think they should take some focus and they should take some note and not just dismiss this part of the community because it's small. And I know that I've argued on other shows that it makes business sense for Apple to do what they're doing, and I still believe that. I still ultimately believe that. I don't think they need to update the Mac every year, but I do think they need to do significant updates more than every 3 years or 5 years or however long it's been since the Mac Pro has been updated. And I do believe that they can't continue to ignore the small but, you know, very important pro part of their market. And it's just feeling like that's what they're doing right now. So 2017 is coming. I'm hoping we see some significant changes, especially on the Mac side. But at this point, only time will tell. And I'm sure you have some thoughts and opinions on this. So please share them with us. Shoot me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Here's a little interesting thing relating to the new MacBook Pros that was noticed by Winter. He emailed me and pointed me to a 9 to 5 Mac piece that claimed that Apple, it looks like, has changed the default resolutions that they're shipping the new machines in to use a non-native screen resolution out of the box. According to the report, this is true for all of the new 2016 models, including the 12-inch MacBook, the 13-inch Function Bar and Touch Bar MacBook Pros, and the 15-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar. So, for example, on the 15-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar, when you get it out of the box and you set it up, it's using a scaled resolution, what Apple calls looks like 1680 by 1050. Now, the native resolution of the display is actually 2880 by 1800. And the, you know, in old days before this change happened, it would then typically ship with a looks like resolution of 1440 by 90, which is half the 2880 by 1800. And that's because that's how Apple does, you know, achieves the retina, uses the retina pixels, but makes it so everything isn't so tiny that you can't read it, right? So you get an effective resolution of 1440 by 900 in that 2880 by 1800 pixels. And so that's kind of the native, you know, what we're going to call the native resolution of the display. But now they're using a scaled resolution, 1680 by 1050, as the default, which is a significant change because, you know, why does this matter? Well, there's a couple reasons. Using a scaled resolution, some might actually notice a little bit of blurriness. It's having to interpolate pixels that aren't necessarily really there. It's not a direct, you know, you can't do a direct, you know, half or 2x or 4x resolution change to kind of reach that resolution. It also, according to some reports that I've read, and I don't know how true this is, they're saying it could put some more stress on the GPU because it needs to interpolate the pixels that are being displayed on the screen. Logically, that sounds like it makes sense to me, but I don't know if that's actually a problem or not. Of course, the main advantage of using a scaled resolution is that you end up with more desktop space than the native resolution would typically provide. And in looking at it, apparently many don't notice any of the quality issues. And you can actually play around with this on your Mac as well. If you go into the system display preferences, and I tried this on mine, go to displays and change the resolution from default for display to scaled, you can play around with the various resolutions and see sort of how they work. And I like tried bumping my Retina MacBook Pro 2015, which has a native resolution of 2880 by 1800, and the default is set to looks like 1400 by 900. I tried changing that to the 1680 by 1050 resolution that the new MacBooks are shipping with, and I couldn't really tell much of a difference in terms of the sharpness of things on the screen. I guess if you look really closely at the edges of some of the text, there might be a little bit of blurriness, but it's really not that noticeable. And I think that's why Apple is changing sort of that default shipping resolution. But if it bothers you, and for some people it might, especially graphic designers and things like that, that want that pixel accuracy, you can go into your system preferences, into displays. You can select scaled instead of the default, and you'll notice it will be on the default, but it's using that, you know, looks like non-native resolution. Just change it, you know, put it back to the one that maps to one half of the display's native resolution, and that should take care of it. So I don't think this is a really big deal, but it is an interesting little change, and it'd be interesting to kind of understand why Apple chose to make it with this generation and maybe not a prior generation, say like the 2015 models. But thanks, Winter, for pointing that out, because I would have totally missed that. And then Jeff wrote in to ask me, why is Apple storage so darn expensive, and why do they not give us, you know, why are they being so stingy about the amount of storage we get for free, just 5 gigabytes with iCloud? And Jeff, I think you were asking a question that a lot of people have been asking for a very long time. And I think we've addressed it sort of here and there on the MacCast, but we've kind of never got into it directly. And you also made a great point of saying, you know, Apple's pricing is way more expensive and they gave you way less default storage than some of the other services and companies out there like Amazon or Google or Dropbox and many others. And this is even, I think, now made more aggravating. You didn't specifically mention this, but, you know, I think it's made more aggravating by the fact that Apple keeps adding more services and features that rely on using your iCloud storage or, you know, moving data out of local places into the cloud, sort of forcing you to go beyond that default 5 gigabytes, which means, of course, that you're going to have to start paying, right? And I'm talking specifically about features. You mentioned wanting to use Moments on iOS, on your iOS devices. But hey, if you want to sync all your photos and get all those great memories, you're going to have to use iCloud Photo Library. And guess what? If you've got a large photo library, you're going to be buying more storage. Absolutely, if you want to do that. Or, you know, backing up your ever-growing and multiplying, you know, larger iOS devices. So as you add more iOS devices into your family, you need more storage to be able to back them up. And as they grow, you know, we don't have 16 gigabytes as the standard default level anymore, 32, 64. You know, even just backing that up, you're not going to be able to do that with the 5 gigabytes that they give you for free. And then throw in like macOS Sierra's new document and desktop syncing feature, and wow, you're buying more storage. So the question becomes, why doesn't Apple give us more for free? And why is their pricing not competitive? You know, Amazon Prime, if you have that, you get unlimited photo storage. Google's new Pixel phone, you get unlimited storage for free if you have a Pixel phone. And, you know, only Apple really knows why they're not doing this. But I certainly have my own theories. You know, my guess is that if you look at Apple's services business, which includes iCloud and Apple Music, it is Apple's only business currently seeing large growth in terms of revenue year over year. Look at the third quarter numbers, and it was up 24%. Revenue was up 24% in services year over year from last quarter. And where's that money coming from? It's coming from people buying Apple Music subscriptions and also people buying more iCloud storage. I know in this year, I have added 3 upgrades to my iCloud storage, my own storage, and both of my kids' phones. I've had to add storage so that they can actually have iCloud backups because they don't sync their devices to their computers. That's just crazy. Why would you ever connect your iPhone to a computer to back it up? I know it's frustrating to me, but, you know, it was simpler to pay the 99 cents a year or a month to get them more storage so they would actually have their stuff backed up and I wouldn't, you know, hear the crying when they lost their iTunes playlists or something like that. So, you know, at this moment, services is a revenue generating center for Apple, and adding more services and features that might compel us to buy more iCloud services seems like very good business for Apple. And, you know, we're going to want to take the easy route and get their stuff and not have to sort of hack together some other solution. So what are you going to do? You're going to just buy in. You might grumble about it a little bit, but you're going to buy into it. And I think that's kind of what's going on. As to why they don't worry about competing with services like Google and Amazon, Google and Amazon, you know, their cloud storage for them, it's a loss leader. So they can afford to take a loss at giving you that storage. They're not really concerned about covering their server costs because Amazon ultimately wants to sell you more Prime memberships so that you buy more stuff off Amazon. And they're going to gain back the revenue that way. Google, for them, they want all the juicy metadata that's in your photos for their advertisers. You know, they want to know where you're taking photos, what cameras you're taking them on, what kind of stuff you're doing. And then they can sell that data to advertisers to sell you targeted advertising, and they make their money back that way. So, you know, it's not a profit center for them like it is for Apple. And I think that's kind of the difference. And, you know, Apple does, it's more expensive, but they don't make their upgrade tiers too expensive. You know, it doesn't feel really egregious at this point if you're not comparing. And I think that's the other thing, is I think a lot of people don't go out and do a price comparison. They just go, oh, I'm out of storage, I can't back up, I'll just buy more. What does it cost? Apple says, oh, it's 99 cents if you want 50 gigabytes a month, and the, or 99 cents a month if you want 50 gigabytes. Okay, just sign me up for that. And they move along their merry way, and their iCloud backups continue. So it's not a huge pain point, I don't think, for a lot of people. And until there's a lot of complaining, Apple's really not incentivized to really change it. Now, I mean, perception with tech geeks like you and I, it's annoying, right? But you can kind of see where maybe Apple's coming from. You know, $2 a month for 20 gigabytes or 200 gigabytes of storage, not too bad. $10 a month for 1 terabyte, $20 for 2 terabytes. So, you know, my big complaint personally is their lack of a shared storage plan. You know, each iCloud account for a family has to buy its own storage. So I pay, you know, 99 cents for one device a month, another 99 cents for another device, and $2 for my device. So I'm in it at $4 a month. I'd almost kind of rather pay the $10 a month for 1 terabyte and then be able to divvy that out amongst my family accounts as need be. That'd be a little more convenient for me. But again, I think Apple would be generating maybe less revenue. I guess in this scenario, they'd actually get more out of me up front, but ultimately I'd probably move my wife onto more storage as well, and she'd be able to maybe take advantage of iCloud Photo Library, which she doesn't currently because she just doesn't have the storage for it. So that said, you know, I think ultimately Apple is probably due to change the minimum tiers, especially the free tier, considering the fact that they dropped the 16 gigabytes on iOS devices. I think there is going to be a more vocal core of their users that's going to complain about that. Hey, why can't I back up to iCloud if this is sort of the solution you want me to have for backing up my stuff? I think I should be able to do that, you know, included in the price of this very expensive iPhone that I just bought. And I think that's a reasonable thing to do. So I would imagine we see the 50 gigabyte tier become free at some point. You know, that's a big jump from the 5. Maybe they won't go that far. Maybe they'll go to 25. But again, if you've got a 32 gigabyte or a 64 gigabyte device, 50 may not even be enough. So, and again, comparing to other services, I think they need to be a little bit more competitive. So I think that will happen. I think they need to be at a tier where you can back up a single iOS device to the free tier of storage. And that's probably a good place for them to be. Pricing should come down a little bit more. Maybe move the 200 gigabyte tier to the 99 cent, you know, move everything down one tier and add something larger up on the top. But, you know, I feel your pain. I know what you're talking about. Will it change? I don't know. As long as it's generating profit for Apple, it's going to be a hard thing for them to actually do from a business standpoint. But again, that's just my 2 cents. If you have your own opinions, chime in on it. You're always welcome to give your feedback. As we move into the winter months here in the Northern Hemisphere, Jung sent me an email and pointed out something interesting over at Apple Support. They have an Apple Support article about the operating temperature of iPhones and their batteries. And what he was pointing out was that Apple recommends that we use our iOS devices where the ambient temperature is between 0 and 35 degrees Celsius. That's 32 degrees to 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the low and high temperature conditions that once you get outside of those, it might cause your device to actually behave irregularly or actually start to regulate its temperature. Basically, it will lock you out. And anybody who's lived in an extremely cold or extremely hot environment has probably run into this. They also recommend that you store your iOS device in temperatures between minus 20 degrees to 45 degrees Celsius or 4 degrees to 113 degrees Fahrenheit and say, you know, don't leave your iOS device in the car because temperatures in parked cars could actually exceed this range depending upon, again, what kind of environment you're in. And Jung pointed this out because he's in China and guess what? It probably gets a lot colder than 0 degrees Celsius in the winter, especially in, you know, a number of regions in China. And 0 degrees Celsius in the grand scheme of things is really not that cold. I think about people who are in Chicago or Minnesota or Michigan. You're talking about minus 20, minus 30. It's not out of the realm, minus 40, minus 50 degrees. So what happens to an iPhone in that environment? You know, and I live in an area where temperatures can get really hot. And if you're in Arizona or Texas or, you know, other parts of the desert, it's not that unusual to get 110 degrees, 115 degrees, maybe even higher. So that becomes more of an issue. So it's interesting to think, you know, why is this such a limited range of operating temperatures? And I think part of the reason is that, you know, most people are going to protect their device by wearing the appropriate clothing. You know, your device is not out and sort of sitting in that ambient temperature environment. You've got it somewhere in a pocket, or you're in a really hot environment, you've probably got air conditioning going on in your car, or you're in an air conditioned environment. I've actually seen this become more of an issue in warm environments because you might be out hiking, or you might be out, where even having the device in your pocket, it could still heat up, it could still get warm, or you're out at the beach and you're laying there, and you could very easily exceed the 95 degree temperature. And when you do that, your phone will, you know, basically display this black screen, an extreme temperature zone warning, and you can't use the device till you actually get it into a normal temperature operating range. So that can be a little bit frustrating, but I thought it was very interesting, you know, again, how limited this was, but I think it ultimately sort of makes sense because the chances that your device is going to get into that kind of ambient temperature environment, I don't think is really the case. Again, you could still, I know people who take their iPhones out in very cold environments all the time. They use them. You're going to pull it out, use it for a couple seconds, put it right back in that nice warm pocket you've got in your coat right next to your warm body. And its ambient temperature probably isn't going to regularly exceed the sort of range. But it is interesting to see it in a support article and to look at the actual temperature ranges and go, wow, freezing to 95 degrees, you know, Fahrenheit, that's really not that big of an operating range. All right, last thing that I have for you today is a couple of app recommendations for the thing of the moment, or I guess I should say things of the moment. And these are for helping you figure out the appropriateness of media for kids or maybe even yourself, dependent upon, you know, how you feel about certain sorts of things like language and violence and things in your films and books and that sort of stuff. And a great source that I use in my family for this is Common Sense Media. And they have a really great app that provides age ratings for all sorts of things, video games, books. And I know you can get these from, you know, the MPAA and all these other things, but these are more sensible ratings, especially if you're monitoring the media for kids. And they rank things not just overall, but with an overall age rating, but also for things like violence, sex, positive role models, language, positive messages, consumerism, drinking and drugs. So they break it down into different categories because everybody's going to have different feelings and different opinions within their own family about how you would rank any one of these things. So, you know, for us, you know, violence isn't necessarily a huge issue. We're concerned about it, but it's far less of an issue for us than, say, like sex in movies or something like that, that we maybe don't want our kids at their current age to kind of come across. Consumerism, not such a big issue for me. Language, it's a little bit of an issue, but again, not a really big deal. So what's great about Common Sense Media is they give you not just the ratings, but then you can drill in on each one of those and get specifics, including citing specific scenes or passages or things that are in the media and explaining, okay, here's why it has this rating for violence, or here's why it has this rating for drugs and alcohol depiction in this content. And not only that, when you go into the reviews, they break the reviews down by not just an overall review, but what parents need to know, what's the story, is it any good, and what I really like, what families can talk about. So, you know, if there's issues or things that come up within the context of that media, here's the kinds of things that maybe you want to cover with your kids so they can better understand, you know, why this was depicted in this film or this was, you know, written about in this book and stuff like that. So it's a very helpful guide to kind of help parents make, I think, good decisions about the kinds of media and the kinds of things that they're exposing their kids to. And like I said, I even like to use it just for myself because there's certain kind of content and certain kinds of movies and things that I just don't like, you know? So I kind of want to know, what am I going to be seeing here? And you can get some spoilers sometimes, so you have to be a little bit aware of that. But generally, you know, it works out pretty well. The other thing that Common Sense Media does that I love and is in the app, you can get user reviews and the age rating further broken down by the age rating that parents give it versus the age rating that kids give it. And you can break down the reviews by kids' reviews and parents' reviews. And I found that almost always the parent rating seems to be about 1 to 2 years older than the kids' rating in terms of appropriateness. So that's very interesting. And another nice thing is that Apple actually includes the Common Sense Media age ratings on the new Apple TV for their content. I believe it's actually what Siri on the latest Apple TV uses when you ask, hey, show me movies for an 8 year, you know, appropriate for an 8 year old or something like that. It's using the Common Sense Media age ratings, and that's how it gets that. So that's one. The other app that I like to use and the other website that I like to use is a site called Kids in Mind. And it's not as pretty as Common Sense Media, but what I like about it is that it's much more detailed in the descriptions for each ranking that it gives. Now, it has sort of less categories. They break it down in terms of sex and nudity, violence and gore, and profanity, but under each one of those categories, they go into really specific detail, scene by scene, of what's in there and what generated that rating. So if you want to get a really good sense of what's in this film, and I've used both of these tools for movies that I've even seen already, especially from my childhood, to kind of go back and figure out, okay, I remember it this way from when I was a kid, and I think it's going to be okay for my kids, but when I go back and read the descriptions, oftentimes I'll go, whoa, wait a minute. I don't remember. I remember that now that it's saying it, but that's probably not appropriate. And I've caught myself doing that where I was going to show a film or expose my kids to a piece of media that it turns out I really probably didn't want to. You don't want to have those like, uh-oh moments right when you're sitting there with your kids watching a film. You're right in the middle of it. So I find it really great for that. Their depictions are much more helpful, I think, than the overview ones that are in Common Sense Media. So I kind of combine the two. I check on both of them. And in general, I would say Kids in Mind is much more conservative about their ratings than Common Sense Media. But between the two, I think you can really get an overall sense of what's appropriate for your family. So I think they're really great tools. I can't believe I haven't talked about them before. So those are my things of the moment for this week. Common Sense Media and Kids in Mind. And I'll have links to those in the show notes at MattCast.com. And they're both available in the App Store, and you can check them out. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's products by visiting smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Plus, Drobo. Drobo, a family of safe, expandable, yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. This holiday season, give someone a Drobo to keep all of their files and memories safe forever. And remember, you can save 20% or more at drobostore.com by using the code MC20. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're always welcome to send your feedback. You can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media and would like to follow me between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you're on Google Plus and prefer that, you can find the Google Plus community at google.com/PlusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.